From KUAZ, Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up on today's show, another important ballot measure coming before Arizona voters in November is Prop 102, which seeks to redefine the legal definition of marriage. Christopher Conover talks to supporters of Prop 102, as well as advocates for legalizing gay marriage. Arizona Opera is celebrating the opening of its 38th season with a production of one of the most beloved operas, Verdi's Rigoletto. James Reel talks to Arizona Opera Artistic Director Joel Revson and the director of Rigoletto, David Gately, for a preview. Pam White brings us the story of a local horse trainer who had 100 days to break and train a wild Mustang for a national competition. As you'll hear, he ended up with an even bigger job than he expected. And hear the music of twin sisters Andrea and Juliet Wilhelmi, who comprise the band Mirror Image. A song they wrote has recently received the honor of being a winner in the John Lennon International Songwriting Contest. That's all coming up next on Arizona Spotlight. For the second time in as many years, Arizona voters are being asked to make a decision on the future of same-sex marriage. State law already prohibits it, but Proposition 102 seeks to make an amendment to our state's constitution, and that could block any future court decisions in favor of same-sex unions. We'll hear from some who are for and against Prop 102, and this report from Christopher Conover.
In 2006, Arizona voters defeated the Protect Marriage Amendment by less than 4%. What was then known as Prop 107 stated, quote, "To preserve and protect marriage in this state, only a union between one man and one woman shall be valid or recognized as a marriage by this state or its political subdivisions, and no legal status for unmarried persons shall be created or recognized by this state or its political subdivisions that is similar to that of marriage." Now, 2 years later, Arizona voters are again facing a constitutional amendment dealing with gay marriage. And what is now known as Prop 102 leaves out the language about legal status for unmarried people. Kelly Malik is a spokesperson for the Phoenix-based group called Yes for Marriage, which is backing this year's Prop 102.
Proposition 102 is 20 simple and clear words that define marriage as the union of one man and one woman. So the language is really simple, pretty easy for people to understand, and because they've kept it so simple, it eliminates any confusion.
Jason Cianciotto is the executive director of Wingspan, a community center for Southern Arizona's gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender community. He says opponents of Prop 102 have a simple message.
We're going to see voters send a clear message to the Phoenix politicians. Trust our vote. We said no on this. We meant it the first time, and we're voting no again.
Jason's reference to Phoenix politicians is because Prop 102 was put on the ballot by the legislature. In fact, it was the last vote in the Senate that put the measure there. And that vote was not without political drama and controversy as opponents tried to stage a filibuster and backers worked to keep that from happening. It even ended with a brief ethics investigation of one member of the Senate who ended that filibuster. Opponents of congressional candidate and state Senate President Tim Bee claim that he's the one who put the amendment on the ballot by casting the deciding vote. But shortly after that vote was taken this summer, Bee gave us a slightly different explanation.
Let me first clarify, Senate rules require that the president is the last vote that's cast on the floor on every bill. So while I was the last vote cast on that bill, I'm the last vote cast on every bill as per the Senate rules. This is an important issue for Arizona to consider. It's been a very contentious battle at the legislature this year. It's been one that's very hard to garner the votes for. I believe ultimately, though, that the citizens of District 30, the ones I'm elected to represent in this chamber, would like to have the opportunity to make a decision on that.
Opponents of Prop 102, like Wingspan's Jason Cianciotto, say the proposed constitutional amendment is redundant.
I think it's important to remember that same-sex marriage is already illegal in this state. There is a statute defining marriage as between one man and one woman that was upheld by our lower appellate courts, and that ruling was stayed by our Supreme Court. So when Folks in support of 102 claim that we need to protect ourselves from so-called activist judges. People need to remember that our judges, our courts, have already upheld our existing law that defines marriage. This is redundant and unnecessary and a distraction from the issues that are really important in this election.
Not surprisingly, Kelly Malik and other backers of the amendment have a different view.
It is a law in Arizona, but as many people have seen, the law can be changed. And so if we want to keep politicians and judges out of the definition of marriage, we can do that by amending the Constitution once and for all and defining it as the union of one man and one woman.
2 years ago, 8 states had ballot propositions banning gay marriage. Only Arizona failed to pass that proposal. So the eyes of the nation are now turning to the state this November. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
Even if you don't consider yourself a fan of opera, this music probably sounds familiar. It's from Giuseppe Verdi's Rigoletto, which has become one of the most popular operas of all time since it debuted back in 1851. This month, Arizona Opera begins their 38th season with a new production of Rigoletto. James Reel spoke with the opera's artistic director, Joel Revson, and the stage director, David Gately, to bring us a preview. James begins by telling us a little about the way that past productions have approached staging this opera.
In the 1970s, Arizona Opera did a story theater production of Rigoletto with minimal sets, very eclectic costumes, a lot of pantomime, and a lot of people in the audience did not like it. So almost by way of apology, the company did another Rigoletto a couple of seasons later that was very traditional, set it in Renaissance Italy with the traditional costumes, and everything was very straight ahead, Verdi Rigoletto. There's the famous version set in New York's Little Italy with gangsters and Rigoletto as the bartender. I wonder, David Gately, as the stage director for this weekend's Arizona Opera production, what's your concept of Rigoletto?
It's hard to talk about the big C word, the concept word. But this veers towards a more traditional approach of Rigoletto. The interesting thing about Rigoletto is that when it first came out, it was a very shocking piece. The censors made Verdi change it from a king to a duke because there couldn't possibly be a king who could act in this licentious manner. And there is no like real hero or heroine in the piece. They're all very, very flawed characters. So it was quite shocking in its original when it first came out. I try hard to get some of that shock value back into the piece. So while I say it's a traditional production, to me, that sort of people have an idea of Rigoletto as this sweet sentimental tale about a father and his daughter. And I try to veer away from that a little bit and show the really dark motivations that make all these people work.
These are not pleasant people by and large. The Duke of Mantua, as you mentioned, is a licentious character, a womanizer, seducing everything in sight. His courtiers are insulting people. Rigoletto, the court jester, insults them. The Duke seduces Rigoletto's innocent, naive daughter, and toward the end, Rigoletto plots his revenge. I guess Gilda, the daughter, is the one really sympathetic character among all these people, and why don't we hear just a little bit of her music now? She's like a schoolgirl, daydreaming about her boyfriend and writing his name in her notebook over and over and over, isn't she?
Yeah. The interesting thing about it, it's very sensual music, and yet it's the sensuality of a teenage girl. She doesn't know what, you know, all the ramifications of love and sexuality and all that mean. And, you know, she is the sympathetic character in the show, but even she is majorly flawed. She has this huge blind spot where the Duke is concerned and in the end gives up her life for someone who's not really worthy of that.
We haven't talked yet about the title character, Rigoletto, the hunchbacked court jester. And in the end, he goes so far as to try to have the Duke murdered. Would you say perhaps that he's the villain in his own story?
He's certainly the victim of his own story. I don't know that villain is the right word. He's not a likable character. In the first scene, we see him really doing horrible things to the courtiers, and that is with the permission of the Duke. And we see that he's not a likable character. The only positive sort of thing he has is this incredible love for his daughter. And he does everything he can to protect her. And in the end, that in fact is his own undoing.
Joel Revson, you're the artistic director of Arizona Opera, and you've put together a season that starts with Rigoletto, which we've been discussing, continues in November with The Mikado of Gilbert and Sullivan. In January, we have Donizetti's Elixir of Love. In February, Don Giovanni of Mozart. And in April, it's Puccini's Tosca. With the financial situation the way it is nationally, what does that mean to Arizona Opera in terms of its ability to raise money, to sell tickets, even to engage artists? How is it affecting you, Joel?
Well, it's very curious for us because this financial difficulty, particularly in the state of Arizona, has been going on not just in the last 2 weeks. This has been going on for a couple of years with the financial mortgage meltdown and real estate challenges in this state. Ironically enough, we were able to balance our budget for the first time in over a decade last year. Contributed income was up 19%. And this season, already subscription sales are up 12% over last year. So I believe at least my sense of it, and of course we're just beginning this season and what has happened in the last week to the financial markets may indeed prove me wrong, but I believe that in times of enormous stress and difficulty for people and fear, people look for an escape. And what I believe opera does is it opens the door to a world where people can experience their deepest emotions on stage.
Arizona Opera presents a new production of Rigoletto this Saturday and Sunday at the Tucson Music Hall. We have a link for more information online at KUAZ.org. Coming up in the second half of the show, we'll bring you the story of a man with a mission, gaining the trust of a wild Mustang in less than 100 days. And hear the music created by twin sisters who live in Tucson that was made possible because of the legacy of John Lennon. That's coming up next on Arizona Spotlight. Welcome back to Arizona Spotlight. One of the less publicized legacies of President Richard M. Nixon's administration is a law that protects wild Mustangs. The Free Roaming Horse and Burro Act was established in 1971. Today, as development encroaches and the sale of public lands continues, experts predict that the wild Mustang could vanish from their natural ranges within 20 years. But there's a unique program at work that could help save them. It's called the Extreme Mustang Makeover, and its purpose is to show the public that not only are these wild horses beautiful, but in the right hands, they can be trainable. Pam White brings us the story of a man and a horse who stepped up to the challenge.
I'll just keep his feet a-moving.
Horse training is in Lanny Leach's blood.
The cold starting is my first love, my first forte. Stop. Go the other way.
He works with everything from horses with bad habits to ones like this.
And I'll just let him to kick at it.
Green or young horses. And whether they are for the show ring or just for pleasure, Lanny's goal is to make them safe and rideable.
That's what's neat about a horse. They never lie to us. Whatever they're showing expression on the outside is what they're feeling inside, so I take heed to that.
A rancher's son, Lanny began riding almost before he could walk. His first stint as a trainer was at age 12.
The guy didn't know that I would have done it for nothing, but he actually paid me for doing it. So it just kind of evolved from there.
Now Lanny is facing a challenge of a lifetime. Mustangs roam freely on public rangelands throughout the West and have had no contact with human beings.
Mustangs have a real strong survival instinct in them. They will use their feet on you if they feel like they are threatened, not because they're a mean horse, because they're a protective horse.
Lanny's one of 400 trainers chosen from across the country, taking part in the Extreme Mustang Makeover, a $70,000 competition sponsored by the Bureau of Land Management and the Mustang Heritage Foundation.
We got 100 days to showcase these horses on what we can do with them and what they can do with us.
Mustangs were randomly assigned to the trainers, so Lanny had no idea what he was getting into when he picked up his horse on June 14th in Nevada.
He turned out to be better than my expectations.
Lanny named his horse Traveler. Today, Lanny can watch videos of their first training sessions together when he was still trying to build a rapport and gain Traveler's trust.
I start being the one to move his feet to establish a little bit of leadership role. He had a lot of snort in him. Wild horses usually do. All I'm doing here is trying to find a spot for him to allow me to touch, whether it's on his forehead, on the side of his forehead. I'm just trying to find where he says, okay, Lanny, that's okay.
Since then, Lanny's been working with Traveler almost every day.
He went through that process from a wild horse to here, and it's all because of time spent with him. If I say, let's go climb Mount Lemmon, he'll say, okay, Lanny. He'll do it without frowning. He'll do it without sassing. He'll just say, okay.
After the competition, the Mustangs will be auctioned off to the highest bidder and the money used to support the wild Mustang herds. Even though thousands of Mustangs are removed each year and made available to the public for adoption, there's still an excess of horses, and what to do with them is a controversial issue. One proposal is to euthanize them.
I'm the last guy I would say, you know, go put them horses down, especially if they're capable of turning out to a horse like this.
Lanny's pleased with what he's been able to do with Traveler and is looking forward to showing him off. What he didn't expect, that he'd lose his heart in the process.
He's starting to get a hold of me, you know, that he nickers at me, you know, when I walk by, you know, it's not that he's ready to get fed. He's just saying, hi, Lanny, where are you going? You know, that's kind of.
Now it's all about what can be done to help the plight of the Mustang and his best friend, Traveler. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Pam White.
The Mustang competition was just held in Fort Worth, Texas. Lanny and Traveler placed among the top horses, competing against over 100 entries. Even more importantly, Lanny has since found a good home for Traveler right here in Tucson. This past Thursday, October 9th, would have been the 68th birthday of John Lennon. His widow, Yoko Ono, has worked diligently to keep John's memory and his message alive for new generations. One example is the John Lennon Educational Tour Bus, which since 1998 has traveled across the country, providing free hands-on programs to hundreds of aspiring musicians and giving them access to a mobile, state-of-the-art recording studio. Two young musicians who had the opportunity to record and to make a video on the Lennon bus are twin sisters Juliet and Andrea Wilhelmi, who perform as Mirror Image. They came to Tucson 3 years ago from the small town of Roundup, Montana, and they're juniors at St. Gregory College Preparatory School. Not only did they get a chance to record their song, It actually became the winner for best song in the jazz category of the John Lennon International Songwriting Contest. It was voted on by a panel of celebrity judges, including Bob Weir and Al Jarreau. I asked Andrea Wilhelmi to tell us how the whole process started.
That started actually with the Tucson Battle of the Bands, because we just kind of, we sent in our three songs, you know, just kind of to see what would happen. We didn't expect to get anywhere with it, so we were amazed when we got into the top six. And then they announced, like, the third place and the second place. And these were, you know, rocker bands, guys with the spiky hair. So we felt like it had been some sort of cruel joke, you know, that we were in this. But then they announced the winners from St. Gregory. We just completely freaked out.
Because you knew then it must be you.
Uh-huh.
How did you end up being in the Battle of the Bands in the first place? Where does your musical collaboration start?
Well, we grew up in a really musical home. We grew up listening to our parents' old records of, like, the Beatles and James Taylor. And we played the piano, and I played the clarinet, and Andrew played the flute and the band and stuff. And then when we were 12, we got guitars for Christmas. And I don't know, we just kind of took off from there.
Did you find it natural to write music together and to play together?
Yeah, we just started writing. I mean, now we can't really write songs together. That's too big of a clash of artistic energy, I guess you could say. A lot of door slamming. But we do collaborate on arranging songs. And
when you perform live, it's just two guitars?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. How you do it?
So far. At this point, yeah. Yeah.
Well, how did you get the full sound on the recording A Miserable Thing?
I don't know. Just the guys on the bus were so great, and they just mixed it really well. And, like, I don't know, it's really a state-of-the-art recording studio that they have in there.
So you win the Battle of the Bands, and therefore they put you in contact with the John Lennon people? Or how did
that That was part of our first prize was to spend a day on the John Lennon tour bus recording a song and then a music video. And, you know, we were tired when we got there. It was early in the morning, and we'd been up late night before celebrating. And they told us that in order to record the music video, we were going to have to sing the song 30 times. And they weren't exaggerating. We sang the song 30 times.
Tell us about where you shot the video.
Well, we shot it in Club Congress.
Was that the first time you'd been in Club Congress?
Actually, yeah. And it was really great because we went back there and the tap room. We found all these mirrors, and it was kind of perfect because, you know, we're called Mirror Image and everything. And so, yeah. Yeah, Seamus on the bus who did the photography, he was really excited about all the shots that he got with the mirrors, and so that was really cool.
So tell me about the song Miserable Thing, which is a great title, by the way.
Thank
you. How did that come about? Who started writing the project?
I started writing it.
Okay, Andrea.
And Andrea, yes. I set out to write something with a little more of a jazz sound, and I don't know, because in this lyrics, kind of the character in the song, she's in love with somebody that she shouldn't be in love with, but at the same time, the music has a really playful kind of feel to it, so I ended up getting a neat irony with that.
Oh, it's a miserable thing, the way you're always prancing around my feet. How am I gonna get a jazz name if I can't even get up the street? Oh, it's a miserable thing.
Julia, can you tell me about your contribution to Miserable Thing?
I don't know. I guess I kind of pestered Andrew into working it up. I was like, oh, this is really good. And, well, I don't know. I wrote the high guitar and harmony parts for it. Well, I had it longer. Like, I had an extra kind of half a verse tagged on to the end of it, but she persuaded me to take it out and ended up being glad I did because
we
could
help
long.
Each other that way because it's really hard to take something out of your own masterpiece. It's easier to have somebody else do that, and that's kind of the advantage of having the two of us.
We also rewrote the melody a little bit.
People at home don't know this because they're not sitting across the table from you, but you're twins.
Yeah.
So I find your speaking voices to be different. Are your singing voices radically different?
I think they are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that's just me. I mean, they blend, but at the same time, they're different. I guess, I don't know. We've always kind of had an ear for harmony.
And especially Andrea. I mean, she's the one who really will just improvise randomly when somebody's singing.
Andrea, what were you trying to say, essentially, with the song Miserable Thing?
I don't know. I kind of was writing through a different voice. It was just about, you know, being infatuated with somebody who you shouldn't love or who doesn't love you back. And the character in it is scolding herself for that. So I don't know. It's kind of a...
Something that I see in it is just kind of how people's personal tragedies aren't really as tragic as they seem sometimes, because it has that irony with the lyrics and the music kind of playing off each other.
What do you say? Can there be more than 24 hours in a day? When fortune laughs, oh, catch your backpack. And you know it to unwind. You've got a heavy head and the wires of your mind. Oh.
Mirror Image still has a chance to become a grand prize winner or even Song of the Year in the John Lennon International Songwriting Contest. You can hear more music from Andrea and Juliet Wilhelmi online. Just follow the link at KUAZ.org. There's also a link for the music video for Miserable Thing, and it was shot entirely at Hotel Congress downtown. The place to go is KUAZ.org. And now here's Christina Gonzalez with a look at some weekend events around Tucson.
The 2008 Tucson Film and Music Festival is happening on this weekend at the Screening Room on Congress Street and Plush on 6th Street. Filmmakers, musicians, and their audience are encouraged to connect with each other. Screening and concert information at TucsonFilmAndMusicFestival.com. Downtown El Presidio Park is the location for Tucson Meet Yourself this weekend. The event includes three stages of performances, folk art demonstrations, and not to mention 30 ethnic food booths offering many delectable treats. The event starts at 11 a.m. Saturday and Sunday and is open to the public. Discover the historic hauntings of Tucson at the Southern Arizona Transportation Museum downtown. Paranormal author Kathleen Dobson Hunt will discuss many of the supernatural phenomenon in the downtown Tucson area. This includes a walking tour of several locations still believed to be haunted. The event is this Saturday night from 6:30 to 9:30, and there's more information at TucsonHistoricDepot.org. The Arizona Repertory Theater previews its production of Shakespeare's Love, Labor's Lost this Sunday afternoon at 1:30. This classic romantic comedy is told with a contemporary twist at the Twinnaby Theater located at Park and Speedway. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christina Gonzalez.
That's Arizona Spotlight for this week. Thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio, Arizona Public Media, and was produced in the KUAZ studios by Ginger Duran, with production assistance from Matt Felix. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. Most of the music heard on our program, including the theme, was written and performed by Calexico. I'm Mark McLemore.